Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. And we are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be live with Mayor David Koss talking about the election results in New Mexico and across the United States. Right now, I'd like to welcome Chris Smith. He's the director, writer, and cinematographer of the film The Pool, which opens here in Santa Fe on Friday, November 7th at the Center for Contemporary Arts. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you.
This is a film set in India about a teenage boy from a village who's working in a big city to support his family, and he becomes fascinated by a house with a beautiful swimming pool. He sits in a mango tree watching this pool and eventually the people who own the house. And he eventually meets the owner of the house and his somewhat sullen teenage daughter. Now, this film is made after a short story by Randy Russell and is originally set in Iowa. How did you come to adapt it for film and set it in India?
Well, it was in large part based on an experience I had. I was in Panjim, where we made the film, about 4 years earlier, and had stayed at this hotel and sort of just observed the room boys that were working at this hotel, and there was something that felt so universal about their daily lives that it was an aspect of India, of like a foreign culture, that I feel like isn't often represented when people travel or go to make films overseas. So, you know, in general, it seems like it's either these big landscape, you know, drama, vista dramas, or else it's something with extreme poverty. But basically, I just had a strong reaction to the short story, and there was a central theme that I really liked about it, which was basically, you know, this guy who lived in Iowa City became obsessed with a swimming pool and tried to meet this family in an attempt to get closer to the pool. But what happens in the short story is that the relationships become more important than this desire to swim in the pool. So it was really just sort of using that as a starting off point, and then melding it with this experience I had when I had been to India about 4 years earlier, and we stayed at a hotel in Panjim where we eventually shot the pool. And so it was sort of my experience of being in that city and taking in, you know, for the week that I was there, the culture. And to me, what lasted with me was the people I met, and the character of this particular city was really interesting because it had this low-lying area which had a lot of energy and chaos and activity. And then there was this hill in the middle of the city that was very quiet and peaceful and had all these beautiful old Portuguese mansions. And so, you know, when I thought of combining these Randy's story with this, the layout of the city, and the observations I had of the kids that were working at this hotel, it all sort of came together in that way.
So the teenage boy whose name is Venkatesh Chavan, and that's the name of both the actor and the character, and that's the way it is with all the characters in the film. He's actually a non-actor, as his younger friend, whom he hangs out with, and who's also a wonderful character in the movie. Who were these boys, and how did you find them?
Well, Venkatesh actually, oddly enough, was in the short film that I went to film 4 years earlier. My friends were making a film over there, and they literally found him on the street. His family worked in the scrap business, so they basically would go from business to business and collect cardboard or plastic and basically go make money by recycling it. And so he was walking down the street one day, and he had these giant sunglasses on and just sort of caught their eye, and they put him in their film. And when we went back, we never had the intention of finding him again or using him, but we just sort of came across him while we were doing casting. And in going through hundreds of kids, he just sort of seemed the most interesting for what we were for the character that we were looking for.
I love that you cast somebody who was not, I mean, if this were an American mainstream film, the 17-year-old boy would have to be very handsome. And this is a sort of almost geeky, gawky-looking boy who is so perfect and so natural in his role.
Yeah, I think he's, you know, for me, it's just finding people that are dynamic on screen, and I think Venkatesh is oddly charismatic. You know, he's got he's interesting to watch, and his friend Jahangir is equally, you know, interesting in a different way. And they both, I think, together make this incredible sort of duo that sort of work that makes the film really work.
Did you learn much about the subculture of these young people who come from villages? I mean, one of the things that I learned from the movie is that a lot of them can't read, and they're essentially doing child labor. They're working in hotels and restaurants and so on, and they really would prefer to be in school.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think when you watch our film, I don't think you on the surface that people, you know, think it's a film about child labor, but I think it definitely touches on it. And I think it's interesting because, you know, you look at these kids, and as you mentioned, they can't read, they can't write, but they both, Venkatesh and Jahangir, the two leads in the film, both could speak five languages. Jahangir's only 11, and they were acting in the film. They were acting Hindi. The language that we shot the film in was Hindi, because it was the most common language between all four of the main actors. But neither of their first language. They were having to, you know, we shot a lot of the scenes in quite long takes, like 2 or 3 minute takes. So we'd have to get on set and they'd have to memorize, you know, a good chunk of dialogue. And if you've ever tried to memorize something without actually seeing it on paper, it's incredibly difficult. So they were incredibly smart kids, and they were, you know, I think they were sort of wise beyond their years, but they just weren't educated in a traditional sense.
I would like to say that I love the fact that you did long takes. It is such a contrast to the kind of quick-cutting filmmaking that many of us are used to when we go see regular old Hollywood movies. How did you choose to do it that way? It gives the film such a leisurely pace, sort of. It's more like the pace of life itself.
I guess it was more of a stylistic choice. It was something that we felt we wanted the film to be a very honest, sort of genuine experience, and we wanted it to feel as if you were there and that you were experiencing these things as they happened. So, you know, it was partly a decision just to sort of let the sort of action and the dialogue and the scene unfold in a way that wasn't sort of interrupted or you know, by the filmmaking process. And so for us, it was really just sort of a challenge to try to pull off, you know, capturing these, you know, complicated moments or scenes and trying to figure out how to do them in one single take.
And there's also, you use the for example, the character Venkatesh, you see him going through his day, and you see him doing the same things over and over again during the course of the film, and so you get a sense of the repetitiveness of this young person's life, and yet it's not a repetitious film. It's very, very skillfully crafted.
Yeah, I think that was one thing that was really challenging for us, was just trying to figure out the amount of that material that you could put in, because of course we shot a lot more, and you want to make sure that people understand what world these kids come from and what the prospects for them are and what their daily life is like. But at the same time, you know, it is a movie, it is entertainment, and you want people to understand that without boring them and without sort of hitting them over the head. So it was always a fine line that we were trying to walk, where we wanted people to understand that, but not also do it to the point where it sort of took them out of the film.
We're talking to Chris Smith. His film is called The Pool. It opens on Friday, the 7th of November at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. Another very beautiful and subtle thing about the film is the way the relationships develop. The unself-consciousness of Venkatesh once he starts talking to the wealthy owner of the house, and then the dialogue that the two of them establish with each other slowly in the process of gardening in this wealthy man's beautiful garden.
Yeah, no, it was something that I think, you know, for us, I think when we went over there, part of the approach in making the film was to come up with the story and the structure and the narrative elements over here, but really try to let our experiences while we were there inform a lot of the details that shaped the story. And in doing that, we did extensive interviews with all the actors and tried to work a lot of their real-life experiences into the script. And so a lot of the stories that Venkatesh is telling are actually experiences that happened to him. And so I think that adds an element that's a little bit different than if it was this sort of contrived and made up, you know, from somebody in the United States writing the script. It really adds a realism and that I think gives you an insight into his life that might not have come if it was actually come from someone who was writing it from an outsider's perspective.
Very much so. I mean, it's extraordinary to me that you succeeded in really not imposing an Americanness on the film. You kept yourself out of it culturally, and I guess that's how you did it. I mean, the actors very much shaped the script through their own life experiences.
Yeah, I mean, even the father, you know, had told us a story while we were doing an interview with him, and he just talked about when he was younger, he was very insecure, and he had often would get into these fights, and he lifted up his shirt, and he had all these scars from different, you know, things that had happened earlier in life. And it was interesting just when you looked at, Venkatesh had told us these stories where he had gone into these fights and had all these different scars, and just sort of making those connections and building, you know, finding these moments that these two characters could bond over that were actually based in reality. And I think that just added a level of intimacy to the film that might not have happened if it was just completely sort of contrived in that sense.
Now, thinking about the relationship between the two young people and then the father and the wealthy father and his daughter, it made me think about the relationships between urban Americans and then Latino immigrants, many of whom are from villages. Do you think about that? Did you see any kind of parallel to the U.S.?
I mean, I think it was definitely there. I guess it was just when we were in that world, we really sort of submersed ourselves in that environment and were, you know, really trying to just focus on that particular thing and not try to make a more sort of general statement. I think part of the reason the film was successful is that we not only relied on sort of the actors to inform us, but was really sort of working with our crew and all the way from our production manager down to the translator and letting them, and really they became true collaborators in the sense where they would talk to us and tell us like if something felt false or wasn't accurate or wasn't true. So I think we ended up with a real sort of honest and sort of, you know, a portrait of India at that time, or of that sort of part of India at that time, that is a way that a lot of Indian people have told us they've never seen it filmed.
Yeah, and I think something like seeing parallels to other societies and places is something that the viewers of the film can do. Not necessarily that you intended that, but I think it's part of the strength of the film is that it makes you think about other situations, you know, that exist in the world or in your own life. There's an interesting dynamic when the two boys form a friendship with the teenage girl who's always peppering her speech with English, and there's kind of a dynamic that the viewer of the film is aware of about the relative happiness and unhappiness in each of these young people. For example, Venkatesh has an acceptance of his arranged marriage to be, in contrast to this wealthy man's teenage daughter who has a lot more choices, but somehow a kind of less freedom at the same time. But then Venkatesh can't read and write, and she spends half of the movie reading. So there's very interesting dynamics that come into what becomes quite a beautiful friendship.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what was interesting was just sort of when we brought Aisha, who was the actress, down to meet the kids, there was actually a lot of that energy happened in real life. And so I think we were able to capitalize on a lot of that, because she did come from this other world. She lived in Bombay at the time, was an actress, had just done one film and was coming down, and they really were, you know, playing parts that were very similar to their real lives. So I think the friendship that you see develop in the film was very true to what was happening in real life.
Now tell us the story of how you got the actor who plays the wealthy man, and his name is Nana Patekar, who is a very, very famous actor in India, to play in your film.
Well, we'd been looking for someone to play the father for quite some time, and it was just becoming more and more difficult. And about 3 months into the project, my producer, Kate Noble, saw a photograph of Nana in a newspaper, and there was an article, and in the article it said, you know, why they had asked him why he had taken such a long break between films, and he just said he only works when he finds projects that are interesting to him, and if there isn't an interesting project, then he's not going to work. And so Kate looked at me, and she was like, well, we're an interesting project, and she had just immediately become, you know, just convinced that he was the right guy for the part. He if you looked at his photograph, just something in his eyes, and we were looking for someone that had this quiet, you know, that was able to say a lot without saying anything at all. There was something just in the photograph and the way that he looked that we felt like there was a good chance that he could be that person. And so we went to Bombay, and Aisha, the director of the film that Aisha had been in before, got us a meeting with Nana. And unbeknownst to us, when we went there, he actually didn't have any intention of doing the film. I think it was more he was sort of curious why the small American film crew believed that this star of his caliber would even entertain the idea of being in this film. So we went to his house, and the first thing he said was, "I'm not going to do your film," but you know, he wanted to know what we were doing and why. And we ended up talking to him for about an hour and a half or 2 hours, and sort of explained ourselves and what we were trying to do. And at the time, we'd already cut about 45 minutes of the movie, so we had brought that with us. And so we ended up showing it to him, and he watched the film in silence. And he's got a very sort of intimidating personality in some ways. He doesn't talk very much, and he just watched it in silence. And then just at the end, he looked over to us and just said that he would do the film. So I think he responded very favorably to what he saw, and he said what he liked about it was just that it was so many times people come over and they show the street kids, you know, in sort of destitute and not doing much. And he just said he liked how this was a positive aspect in the sense that it showed that a lot of these kids are actually fairly intelligent and they're very hardworking and they're trying to make something of themselves. And he responded to that portrayal.
It's a real testament to your filmmaking that one of the great stars of India who had said no would take a look at the film on your laptop and immediately change his mind. It's a truly beautiful film. It's called The Pool. Chris Smith is the director, writer, and cinematographer of the film. I'd also like to draw attention for a moment to the cinematography, which is very beautiful but doesn't really draw attention to itself until you watch it the second time. I was watching it again this morning. It's wonderful cinematography and very, very carefully done. And one of the things I noticed is that you really don't do super close-ups of people's faces.
No.
And so you're not in their heads. You're sort of letting them be in their environments.
Yeah, I think it was, I don't know, I got in my head that it was a film that I wanted people to see in theaters.
Very much so.
And so I sort of shot it, you know, I was sort of watching, I just watched a film called The Passenger, and it was an Antonioni film that was re-released by Sony Classics. And there was just something so great about seeing these sort of big landscapes and seeing things played out in master shots. And I was just really interested in that and not, and sort of letting the audience sort of take it in a way that, you know, you just watch the scene unfold as opposed to jumping in and getting close-ups. And I guess it was just a choice that I made early on, and it was something that we stuck by.
You shot this on 35mm film, which I guess is unusual these days.
Well, I think for a film of our size, it's unusual. I mean, for me, it was important to, I wanted to shoot on 35, and it was something that we, you know, were determined to try to figure out how to do. So we had a small crew, but, you know, we ended up shooting 65 days over 5 months. And, you know, one of the benefits of that is that we're really able to sort of work with our environment and try to wait for the sun to be in the right place. And you know, so we might not have had the biggest crew, but a way around that is this sort of, you know, just the fact that you're shooting on 35mm and then you take advantage of, you know, the way, you know, where the sun is in the day, you know, we were able to really get some beautiful images, and I think to me that was really important to try to, just because it's such an incredibly visual city, in such a sort of different and subtle way than you're used to. You know, to me one of the most striking things is just the buildings in Panjim will have, you know, when people see it, they're like, they'll ask you like, don't they clean, you know, buildings there? But it's when you're there for a year, and you see like the monsoon comes every year and it does the same thing, it's that you start to understand that it's just the sort of decay or organic quality of sort of the patterns on these buildings just becomes part of the city. And I think it's really interesting because we so often try to like cover any, you know, residual effect of nature up in America, but it's
right.
What I think is so nice there is that it just actually blends into the city, and then their use of color is so great. And so for us it was important to shoot on 35 to make sure that all that was captured in a way that transferred into the film.
So what happened to these two young people who were non-actors, who are essentially street kids? What are their lives? Or, I mean, do they have careers now? What's happening for them?
Well, Jahangir ended up taking, they both got paid for being in the movie, and Jahangir ended up quitting his job and enrolling himself in school. So he's actually been in school for 2.5 years now. And Venkatesh went to school for a little bit and then decided he was sort of beyond the age of wanting to go back. He was 18 at the time, and he just, the idea of going back to school with five-year-olds, it just sort of was something that he'd already been working for so many years and basically running his own small business that he sort of, I think he found it too hard to sort of go back and do that. So he did that he worked with the family business for a while. Now he's working in a clothing store in Goa.
Is there a possibility of an acting career for him? Is he interested in that?
The independent sort of film world in India is so different than sort of the Bollywood one, and I don't think it's really, there's so many people that have been in independent films in America that, have been these, small wonders that don't necessarily go on to have acting careers, and I think it's just more of a case of, I think he'll probably be more known in America than he will be in India, just because the film will probably have more of a reach here, because it is more of a sort of, in some ways, an American film than an Indian one.
Has it been shown in India?
Yeah, we did end up going, and we went back and played in Panjim, where we made the film, and Venkatesh and Jangir's families both came, and they were movie stars for a day, so it was really nice. And then we went up to Bombay, and it showed there, I think, a month or two later.
It's very interesting that you say this is more an American film than an Indian one, because as I was watching it, it seemed to me that it's so not an American film in so many ways. But as an American, I can't really sort that out. How do you see that?
Well, it's interesting. Even as I said that, I was sort of questioning myself, to be honest. I guess it's, I'd almost go back to that thing. It's just sort of like as far as him becoming an actor, I was just thinking about that as we had moved on, and it was. It's just not something that's sort of set up in that way, where I don't think the opportunity will be there, to be honest. And it's not by any fault of anyone's. I just think he doesn't live in Bollywood, in Bombay, so he's not near Bollywood. And I doubt the film will sort of garner the attention that it would require for someone to notice him and sort of pull him out and start trying to get him to be in other films, if that makes any sense. And then as far as what kind of film it is, I guess I don't really know. I mean, it was made half by an American crew and half by an Indian crew, and I think a lot of the sensibilities, weren't particularly Indian or American. I think it was just a film that existed in the sense that we were trying to make something, our ultimate goal when we made the film was to make something that, or at least my goal was to make a film that had an emotional resonance with an audience. And it wasn't, it wasn't an intention to try to set out to make a foreign film or an American film, but it was really just to try to make something that felt, that portrayed a place in a way that felt honest, and that you had characters that you could, believe that were engaging, and that it had the ability to move an audience.
Well, you have a lot of courage to do that in a language that you don't even speak, and even more skilled. You are a truly profoundly wonderful artist. You totally pulled this off. And this is a narrative film that you made after having done a number of documentaries. I guess you've done both documentaries and narrative films in the past, is that right?
Yeah, the first film I did was a narrative, and then I got sidetracked and did three documentaries, and this is the first sort of return.
What's next for you?
We're looking at a lot of different things. The independent film world isn't quite what it used to be, so it's been kind of a full-time job just getting this film out and getting people to see it. So we're kind of trying to get through this, and then we'll start to see what's up next.
I read somewhere that you finance your films partly through doing TV commercials. Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that the main way you get these films funded?
It's a combination. I mean, we take every film that we make, we'll take any money we make from that and sort of move it into the next one. And then aside from that, it's been funded entirely by work that we do on TV commercials.
And I have to say, one of my favorite documentaries is one that you made called The Yes Men.
Oh, yeah, that was a fun project.
That was great. That also screened at the CCA some years ago. Chris Smith is the director, writer, and cinematographer of the film The Pool, which opens on Friday, November 7th at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe. And to see more about it, you can go to their actually very beautifully constructed website, which is thepoolfilm.com. Chris Smith, thanks so much for being with us.
All right, thank you.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. And broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, I am joined by Santa Fe's Mayor David Koss. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning.
So this is quite a morning.
This is day two of history here.
Day two of history.
Yeah.
The first African-American president of the United States, first Democrat in a long time, and a strongly Democratic Congress.
This is last night was an amazing, yesterday was an amazing day, and you just wake up this morning, just can't hardly believe it.
So what do you make of it?
Very, very exciting. Well, you know, a lot of things. I think first I feel very humble that we have such a great leader that's come forward and really united this country and changed its direction. I made sure to go see my parents last night because they're getting elderly now, and they've been liberal New Deal Democrats all their lives, and they were active in the civil rights movement and the labor movement, and it was such a special night for them. And I think people my age and older, we could hardly believe that this country was ready to elect an African American, and that we did so in such a dramatic statement. Such dramatic numbers.
The final count for the Electoral College was 338 to 161. That's
a
gigantic.
Almost 2-1 on the Electoral College. And so, as someone that thought we were just going to be slugging it out in the trenches with red state, blue state for a long, long time, to have a leader like Barack Obama says, it doesn't have to be that way.
Colorado and New Mexico, blue states tucked in between red states all around.
Absolutely. New Mexico now has 5 Democratic members of Congress.
That's right.
3 Congress and 2 Senate. That's incredible. That's just incredible for us. And Carol and I went all over yesterday, and the spirit was just amazing. We were at Somos in Pueblo Unido. They were turning out newly registered immigrant voters that had just become citizens and registered, voted for the first time. We were at Labor 2008. The unions called 14,000 people in northern New Mexico for Get Out the Vote. The Obama headquarters, the UDAL Democratic Party headquarters. There was such excitement in Santa Fe yesterday, and we're part of a nation that made a dramatic, dramatic statement to the world yesterday.
And what do you think is the nature of that statement? What are we saying?
Oh, man. we're saying we're a great democracy. Two, we're
that our voting machines finally work? That, kind
well,
of, maybe?
Kind of, mostly. that we're not going to settle for what we've had the last 8 years, that we're a better nation than that. And we're gonna work with the rest of the world. I think, in a large way, we said that the age of Reagan is over. We've decided that we do want Social Security, and we do want health care, and we do want a healthy environment. We do want to take care of our veterans. We do want to move into solar and wind and alternative energies and off of fossil fuel. And it was a pretty clear statement last night.
I think we're also saying that some of the philosophies of that era that were really put forth during the Reagan era and in the succeeding Republican administrations ring kind of hollow at this point. Running campaigns on issues that are essentially discriminatory, like anti-gay.
Running campaigns on wedge issues didn't work. Last night the country said we're done with that. And running on a campaign that says the less regulation we have, the better. That didn't work.
That doesn't work
That
either.
Didn't work. Running on a small government that can't help you when a hurricane comes or a wildfire happens, that didn't work. And it had a great run from 1980 to 2008, but that didn't work. And the country chose a new direction last night.
It'll be very interesting to see, with the nation in such a gigantic amount of debt, particularly to China, how we as a nation and how leadership in Washington chooses to spend the few dollars that we've got left over.
Well, absolutely. And, President Obama was very clear about it from the beginning. He was going to get us out of the war in Iraq. The billions that we spend every month there can be better spent on improving our economy and putting people to work in this country. He was very clear from the beginning, and they attacked him all the way through, that he was going to allow the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy to expire and instead do tax cuts for middle-class people and small business people, and that people making over $250,000 a year, we're going to pay a little bit more in taxes. And that message was embraced by the public.
When change like this comes to Washington, how does it affect a town like Santa Fe?
Well, you know, I think Santa Fe was a community that kept the faith all the way through. You know, this is the city of the living wage. This is the city that supports immigrant rights and workers' rights. This is a city dedicated to changing its economy to respond to the energy situation, to the global warming situation. So I think now what we find, there's so much hopefulness in Santa Fe. It was so evident yesterday everywhere that Carol and I went. But what we find is a Congress now and a president that we think can really be good partners for what Santa Feans have been working on for decades.
I think there's also just simply budgetary questions. When money is spent a certain way in Washington, that
sure
affects the Santa Fe budget.
Well, you know, it absolutely does, and probably one of the most clear-cut examples is our Buckman Direct Diversion Project. We have a $200 million, very, very important piece of infrastructure going forward. And to date, we've had $250,000, $250,000 worth of assistance from the federal government for that project. You know, the fact that we could be doing such a project that is so necessary for northern New Mexico's economy, for our sustainability, and have zero help from our federal government with that. Those are that's just that piece of infrastructure. When you take that and you spread that to water systems, wastewater systems, schools, libraries, roads, transportation systems, and you multiply that underinvestment and that lack of assistance from the federal government for communities in this country, that's when you have bridges falling down. And that's when you have an economy that all of a sudden looks very, very hollow, you know. And I think having a new vision and strong leadership in Washington is going to mean the world to communities like Santa Fe, to cities all over the country.
We're talking to Santa Fe's Mayor David Koss. Let's talk about some of the state and local races. Tom Udall won handily for the Senate, and first-time senator, he's been a representative for the state of New Mexico. And Martin Heinrich won in House District 1, Democrat Harry Teague in House District 2, Ben Ray Lujan in House District 3. So across the board.
Across the board, and races that you thought would be close, like Martin Heinrich and Harry Teague, actually had 10-point margins to them.
Don't they call that landslide once you have a 10-point margin?
Yeah, you're getting into landslide.
What qualifies as landslide?
I think 60% and above.
Oh, 60%,
but
okay.
But there's no formal definition.
Right.
But that 10% in a district, you know, like Martin Heinrich, that's never been held by a Democrat, is very, very significant. It just shows the change that people want to see. I think the other thing it shows, a couple of demographic groups that hadn't been voting before, and that's Hispanic voters and young voters. And Barack Obama and the Democratic Party spoke to them, and they came out and voted. So we had a very, very strong Democratic, big D and little D, event yesterday.
The early voting was so strong, in at least in Santa Fe, and I think
sure
throughout New Mexico, that I had some friends who were poll workers who said, there's nobody here, everybody
right
voted early.
And we had a very smooth election yesterday for the most part, because more than half of Santa Fe County voted early.
So all, but one of the bond measures were passed. What's your sense of how closely people are actually following bond measure questions?
Well, I think, again, it goes to what we've been talking about, Mary Charlotte, is that The people want to see the investment in the infrastructure. They want to see the investment in the schools and the libraries and the senior centers and the veteran centers, in the roads.
And they don't feel that they're losing anything by investing in that.
And they think they're gaining from investing in that. I was very pleased to see that the transit tax that'll help us continue to support the Rail Runner and to develop public transportation in northern New Mexico was passed with a 65% margin. So that, you know, I think the public knows that investment is important, wants us to make investment, and demonstrated that yesterday.
So then there are things like, did you follow the constitutional amendments for the state of New Mexico?
I didn't follow those all that closely this time. It looked like they had a mixed reaction, some passing and some failing. But
some passing and some failing, and I was reading in the Santa Fe Reporter, which endorsed the constitutional amendment number 4, which allows school board elections at the same time as other nonpartisan elections to happen, that the prohibition against that was because women were only allowed to vote in school board elections, so they didn't want to mix women voting with the rest of the votes.
See, there's an interesting piece of history. And so, you know, that's next spring you'll see it. There'll be a school board election, then there'll be a community college bond issue. No, that passed yesterday. There'll be a school board election and a school board bond issue, and then a municipal election. And some years you have, you know, 3 elections in 1 year, and some consolidation is certainly possible.
Let's talk about the city of Santa Fe. What is happening? What are some of the things that you're working on right now in Santa Fe?
Well, we're working very hard now to get ready for the Rail Runner coming into town. We're doing the land use work for proposed stations at Zia and then out in the Los Salados at the south end of town. I think we need a very thoughtful, deliberate land use process to match the fact that the Rail Runner is coming into town. Right now there will only be 2 stops, one at transportation, one at the rail yard itself. So that work is going on. We're working very closely, the city manager, the finance director, and myself, with Chairman Ortiz and the finance committee, because, you know, the recession has started. It is affecting Santa Fe. Our revenues are not in the red yet, but they are down from what we've been experiencing. So we have some very careful financial work to do in terms of where do we hold vacancies. What do we do with pay increases, with contractual services, some of those just day-to-day city budget issues?
Those seem less dire than actual budget cuts.
It's better than actual budget cuts. We hope that we can be able to manage through this downturn, and we will have to slow down in our hiring, in our recruitment, in our filling of vacancies. We were able to accumulate some cash surpluses the last couple of fiscal years since I've been mayor, and we're going to use those to manage through this. You know, I'm hoping that this recession is short-lived, but we don't know, so we have to be very prudent and cautious in how we budget. At the same time, the council is doing some final work on some investment programs. We want to invest hopefully $1 million into a revolving loan program so that homeowners and business owners can retrofit their properties for energy efficiency, maybe be able to put alternative energy, maybe put some solar collectors on their homes. We think that'll be very good for the home builders and the builders in this down market to make some more financing available so people can upgrade their homes and make them more energy efficient. We're looking at putting solar energy as a way to run our wastewater treatment plant, making an investment in that. We're starting $20 million worth of parks improvements, making those investments. We're building another stretch of the river trail right now and restoring the river below Camino Lire. We're, as we work on completing the Buckman Direct Diversion Project, we're also working very diligently on managing our reservoirs in the mountains so that we can really make that 1,000 acre feet of water that the council has dedicated to a living Santa Fe River, make that work to make the river more lively. So,
where is the river at now? I see water in it from time to time.
Well, you know, it's just from time to time the thing that we're trying to get over, where we have at least a minimal flow all the time, as much time as we can have it, because it's really nice when it's flowing and we all love it, but when you turn it on and turn it off and turn it on and turn it off, the wildlife and the insect life just doesn't get the chance to become reestablished in the river.
I suppose it's just like if you lived in a house where the water was only on half the time, you'd probably move.
Right. And you know, a lot of the wildlife and aquatic life has moved. And so, you know, I think we're so far ahead of where we were 10 years ago. I think if the city hadn't purchased the water company and made the investments and the community made the sacrifices that it's made, we wouldn't even be talking about a living river now. But it's a big, complex picture, but we're moving on that. And the community's working so well with us. You know, my hat's off to the Santa Fe Watershed Association for always believing in this for 15 years now, and pushing this ball forward.
You know, this election, it's as if there are a million ideas that have been planted, but they've kind of been paved over with asphalt and not given a chance to grow. And now the asphalt has been removed, and every idea that people and groups and institutions have had and have been discussing in universities about alternative energy and about organic farming and about small communities and the relation, you know, mm-hmm. basically making communities work as a kind of organic organism instead of shipping stuff from a million miles away when it's not necessary, those actually have a chance of happening.
That's what comes from the country choosing hope over fear. I think Santa Fe has been flourishing as a creative community now for a long time, and the thought that now we're able to have national policies and national programs to work with that, with a community like Santa Fe that is so creative. You know, it's very meaningful for me when I'm at Farmer's Market and I'm talking to Don Bustos, who is a former president of the Farmer's Market. He says, you know what the city did with the Farmer's Market and the rail yard was guarantee sustainable agriculture in northern New Mexico for the next 100 years. You know, that's a remarkable statement to me, and it makes you really feel good about all the work you've done when you think, wow, this is so hard, you know, and then, wow, Santa Fe did it, you know, look at this. So, you know, I'm just imagining what it'll be like to have the national government as a partner in what Santa Fe's trying to do.
I think another thing that I admire about Barack Obama is that combination of temperament and intellect that he brings to leadership of this country and will bring to leadership of the country. Some of the, you know, going through this campaign and seeing the pundits just chattering like crazy little, you know, insects, and this very steady presence. Even David Brooks, who's a, you know, real conservative on NewsHour on public TV every night, said, you know, in Barack Obama's campaign, there were very few turning points because he's just steady. And that kind of steadiness is something that one can actually rely on.
I think he's the right man at this time, and I'm just very, very, hopeful and very impressed, because he had this plan 4 years ago. You know, Carol was saying when we watched him talk about we're not red states or blue states, we're the United States. 4 years ago, she said, wow, this guy's pretty impressive. You know, he did the whole, the vision and carried it through. And I think that kind of a vision backed up by the most amazing community organizing we've seen in several generations gives me a lot of hope that we do have the right person becoming president of the United States.
One more note on New Mexico politics. Public Regulation Commission District 3, Jerome Block Jr., who was the subject of many scandals, won the race not by that great of a margin to independent candidate Rick Lass.
Yeah, you know, I think Rick Lass, you know, did a great job. It was an uphill battle. And I think Jerome had a lot of issues, a lot of problems that cost him a lot of support. He has got a lot to prove now, because I didn't find it to be a very inspiring campaign, or even an interesting campaign.
Or even a visible campaign.
Absolutely. I mean, he seemed to me to have run based on he knew it was going to be a good Democrat year.
Right. And people vote straight party ticket.
People voted the straight party ticket.
What would it take to do away with straight party ticket?
Well, it would take a different kind of system than the United States has. You need to look at the parliamentary systems that they have in Europe.
I don't mean the two-party system. I just mean, like, when you fill out your ballot, that you actually have to fill out each little oval with your pen separately.
You know, I don't know. I mean, in the United States, if you're not part of a strong party, you don't really have any much political impact. And so it's, you know, the parties work very hard at that. I couldn't pull the straight party ticket when I voted, but I almost rubbed out the Barack Obama spot. You know, I just wanted to fill that in personally. I wasn't going to just vote a straight ticket, so I wanted to do that. But I, you know, just going back to Jerome Block, you know, that's one of the most important bodies in state government, especially right now.
What do they do?
They regulate all the corporations. They approve any rates that the Public Service Company of New Mexico or Quest might propose. They're in the middle of the regulatory issues. If you're going to move up from coal energy and nuclear energy into solar energy and wind energy, so much of that regulatory structure that's going to make that happen or not happen is with the Public Regulatory Commission. This is the only office in the state that's has public campaign financing. So, you know, we're working on public campaign financing in Santa Fe. I think we have a lot to learn from this race, where you have so many Democrats jump into it, and then you have the one that I think in a lot of ways was least representative of the talent and strength and experience of the Democratic Party in the North, jump into that.
David Koss is mayor of Santa Fe, and here on the day after Election Day, live in the Santa Fe Baking Company, I want to thank you so much for being here.
Well, my pleasure, and I want to thank all of the Santa Fans that worked so hard in this election. And
especially the people who'd never voted before, who got out there and vote, a special congratulations to you.
The people that never voted, but also the people that just worked their hearts out, young and old.
That's right. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we will see you tomorrow. Have a wonderful day. Bye.
KSFR presents a post-election jazz cabaret with the Southwest Jazz Orchestra and Straight Up, featuring John Trent Acosta, Bert Dalton, and Michael Olivola on Wednesday, November 5th at the Lodge at Santa Fe on St. Francis Drive. Come join us for an evening of great jazz in an intimate setting. Tapas, beverages, and dessert will also be available. For tickets, call Linda at 428-1379. That's 428-1379.